Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me for the Relax Back UK show this week. The first topic today is eating disorders.
Where people think that they are doing the healthy thing, but that becomes extreme. There's something called orthorexia, which isn't officially in the kind of diagnostic criteria of eating disorders, but it is still sort of recognised. But it's when people eat extremely clean to an extreme where it causes them so much anxiety and they become really rigid and they can't eat out and it causes, you know, it takes over their life, basically.
I chat with Harriet Frew, eating disorder therapist, about different types of disorder, what causes them, treatment, how to approach the issue if you suspect someone you know is suffering, and much else. Then a sometimes connected topic, diets and fad diets.
66% of people trying to lose weight do not use any evidence-based approaches at all.
Professor James Stubbs from Leeds University is an expert in appetite and energy balance, and Sophie Higginbottom is a dieting success. So please do join me for a great show. Thank you.
This show is cool!
Harriet Frew is an eating disorder therapist and a member of the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy. When I first started talking to her, I suggested that eating disorders might affect more people than at first we might imagine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think often with eating disorders, we have a stereotype of thinking of the young, adolescent, emaciated female, but eating disorders are much broader than that and affect people of all ages, all genders, all body sizes.
We will go ahead and explore that in some detail. But first off, I think the kind of the simplest question and one that, because I've been lucky, it hasn't really affected me. I haven't really had to think about it. You know, what actually is an eating disorder? And there are different sorts, you know, what are the various different types?
An eating disorder is a sort of psychological coping strategy for underlying distress. So the focus is often very much about food, weight and shape, but it's often masking deeper issues. And there are several different types of eating disorder. So anorexia nervosa is probably the one many people have heard of. That's when people often become very, very underweight and very, very sort of thin, restrict their food, overexercise. I'm oversimplifying these a little bit here, but just I'm aware, you know.
That's fine. I'm simple. Yeah.
Then there's bulimia nervosa. People are often normal weight or overweight. People will restrict their eating and then binge eat and purge by vomiting and taking laxatives. Binge eating disorder, where people binge, eat vast amounts of food in secret, lose control, often restricting in between. And then if you don't fit neatly into one of those diagnostic categories, you come under OSFED, which is other specified feeding and eating disorder. They always make up very memorable names. And that's when you don't fit neatly into a diagnostic category, but you may have some of the symptoms of the other eating disorders. Right. And I should also probably just briefly mention as well, ARFID, which is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. That is where the focus is not so much about on weight and shape, but people are avoiding food for sensory reasons, maybe a fear of choking, low interest in food. But yeah, historically, ARFID wasn't really associated with the other eating disorders, which are more the weight shape ones, but now it is seen under that umbrella. So that is a very, very quick whistle-stop tour.
All right. So it does cover quite a lot. Now, how many, or perhaps no one really knows, how many people suffer from an eating disorder? Are there any statistics?
So the National Association for Eating Disorders, BEAT, which is B-E-A-T, if anyone wants to Google it, they say that 1.25 million people have an eating disorder in the UK. That is likely, though, very... you know, many people are not diagnosed. That's probably a real underestimate of the true, you know, representation of people suffering. Also interesting statistic, 85% of people with eating disorders are not underweight. So we often assume, you know, it's the young, emaciated, thin female often, but actually it can affect people in all body weights and shapes.
Okay, so a lot of people, and that may well be an underestimate.
Yeah.
That sounds, yeah, all right. I think something that people don't realise, and I didn't till very recently, that this can be extremely serious. I mean, this can make you really ill. This can kill you. This can make you ill such the effects last your whole lifetime. This is serious stuff.
Yeah, no, it's very serious. I think people often think eating disorders is just about vanity, wanting to be a bit thinner, but actually, yeah, it can really take over people's lives, massively impact their ability to have relationships, engage socially, physically they might be really impacted. You know, anorexia nervosa has the highest mortality rate of any other mental health illness. But I think for a lot of people, they're sort of suffering in that kind of chronic state where it massively interrupts daily life, but symptoms are hidden, but there's a real struggle and maybe they haven't always sought help.
Right. Okay. And so we've mentioned the fact that people actually die. Are there any statistics on how many people actually die from eating disorders?
You know, I don't know the up-to-date statistic on the death rate. I mean, I think... Yeah, I know. Then, yeah, there's something you'd have to Google.
All right, not to worry. I mean, but the fact is, it is extremely serious. Now, something I did a bit of sort of Googling myself and tried to do a bit of research before we chatted, and I came across two phrases. There's eating disorders and disordered eating. Now, is there a difference, and what is it?
So, I guess as human beings, we're all on the spectrum somewhere between full healthy relationship with food and full-blown eating disorder. So we're all on that spectrum at some, you know, point. So if you have an eating disorder, you meet diagnostic criteria where, say, for example, with binge eating disorder, maybe you are binging at least twice a week. You've been doing that for a period of 3 months. If you have disordered eating, you may have quite an abnormal relationship with food. You may have some of those symptoms of an eating disorder, but it's probably not quite as severe.
Okay. All right. No, I get it. Right. So moving on, the sort of reasons that people might suffer from this, I guess a lot of them can be rooted in early life, you know. And one I came across, actually, I spoke to a lady that suffered from this. She was actually a refugee. And so she was a child during a war situation, and, you know, they didn't have enough food. And this really affected her whole attitude to food in later life. Obviously, that's kind of an extreme example. But what sorts of things can bring food problems on, eating disorders on?
Yes, I guess it's quite complex and multiple different reasons, but often it's down to some early emotional stresses. So sometimes it could have been more extreme, like the sort of big T trauma, like abuse or assault or something, or it can often be the little T traumas, you know, so perhaps someone suffered bullying or bereavement or had a critical parent. Also, I think the culture that we live in doesn't help relationship with food. There's a lot of idealization of thin bodies, a lot of weight stigma, a lot of fat phobia. So we've often been brought up with a lot of negative messages around body image, a lot of rules around food. So that combined then with kind of early trauma that can happen, sometimes can be like a perfect storm for an eating disorder.
Right. So it's just something waiting to happen, really.
Yeah, it can often be.
And it can also come on in later life. You know, you can have issues in later life. That's a question more than a statement, really, Harry.
Yeah, no, I think any time where you go through a period of change, a transition, a bereavement, some kind of stress, if you have a history maybe of disordered eating, you could be very vulnerable then to developing a full-blown eating disorder. And I think that's why in the pandemic we saw such an explosion of eating disorders. You know, many people had that sort of disordered eating already with those other stresses, then extreme vulnerability to developing an eating disorder. But yes, at any age of life, not just young people.
So there was an increase during COVID, was there?
Yeah, about sort of 3 times increased rate of referrals, just due to the sort of isolation, the stress, people not having that kind of contact with each other, a lot of online focus, a lot of health and wellness focus. So again, it was a bit of a perfect storm, really.
Okay, all right. Now that's interesting, because in some ways that sort of goes against from one of the thoughts I had about it, because not eating or eating differently is kind of a, this will sound a bit odd, but it was the phrase I came up with, a source of power. You know, if someone's trying to make you eat and you're not eating, actually you've got a bit of a control over them. Okay, you're nodding your head. Put that in some words that make better sense than I've just tried to.
Yes, I think eating disorders often can be about control. If you are feeling overwhelmed, life is very stressful, it can feel like the one thing I can control in my life is my food, my weight, and that can make someone feel quite powerful. But we know that when any human being starts to restrict their food and starve themselves, although that might be very empowering and, in inverted commas, kind of helpful to begin with, we know from starvation studies that it very quickly often leads to disordered eating behaviours. So if someone is restricting, they're very vulnerable to start binge eating. Once they start binge eating, they're very vulnerable to developing other behaviours like purging or overexercise. So what starts off as a way of being in control often rapidly goes out of control.
Right. Okay. But it can start off as this idea of having some power. All right. Can it be brought on by a biological issue more than just a kind of a mental health issue? Are there examples where the kickstart can be a biological one?
Well, I think there's more and more research coming out around biological triggers. And there's some research that indicates that up to sort of 56% of eating disorders have like a biological, metabolic, genetic route to them. I think after working as a therapist for many years in this field, I do think it is a bit like the expression, I don't really like this, but genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. So I don't think that just because you have someone in your family, like supposedly if you have a mother or a sister with anorexia nervosa, you're 12 times more likely to develop anorexia, 4 times more likely to develop bulimia. But I think if you actually have a parent who's quite aware, even if they haven't completely resolved their relationship with food and they consciously parent their child differently, I think that environmental influence can be very powerful, and it doesn't necessarily have to mean that you are doomed to suffering from eating disorder due to your genetics. So I think, again, it's complex.
Okay. You think you hear of children that are fussy eaters because they don't like certain food, et cetera, et cetera. Can that lead on? If children are fussy eaters, can they suffer from eating disorders in later life? Is there a connection there?
Yeah, so I guess if someone's a fussy eater, they may even meet the diagnosis of ARFID. That's the avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. So they might be avoiding food for sensory issues or, you know, picky eating, etc. But I think if you are smaller as a child, if you have some control issues around food, when you hit puberty, you could be more vulnerable then to the weight shape eating disorders because of our culture. So you definitely have a vulnerability, but you're not doomed.
Goodness me. There's more to this then when you start thinking about it. Now here's another question, which is probably a bit unfair, but I'll ask it anyway. If over a million people are ill with this kind of thing, this must cost the NHS a huge amount of time and money.
Yeah, it really does.
Do we know how much?
I don't know. I mean, again, you'd have to Google that. But I mean, yeah, it's incredibly expensive. I think the trouble is as well, by the time people often get into NHS services, they're extremely unwell.
Right.
Like with most things, prevention is much better than cure. And it does cost a lot. And I think what's not very joined up still in our culture is if, for example, you are overweight, you might be recommended by your doctor to go on an extreme diet, to lose weight, to become healthier. But then actually, if you've got an eating disorder, that extreme dieting might trigger your binge eating. So actually you develop an eating disorder, or your eating disorder becomes worse. So we still have a bit of a misunderstanding of eating disorders as a culture. You know, like all the main podcasts you listen to, they'll talk about intermittent fasting or just cut out this, but they never talk about relationship with food, psychology, such an important piece of the picture that needs to be included in all of this.
Well, actually that leads on to a question that I have in lots of nutritionists, And I'm going to call it the wellness industry. I don't know if that's unfair to use that term, but people can be advised to cut out certain food groups. You know, that's not that uncommon. Someone says, oh, you know, my nutritionist says I can't eat this sort of food or that sort of food. And sometimes, actually, this is a lot of food people are cutting out. And I think my impression is this approach for various things is becoming more and more common. Is there a likelihood that that sort of thing can fuel eating disorders in people that were, you know, perfectly fine with food before?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think back in the day, people used to fall into eating disorders more through extreme diets, things like Weight Watchers, etc. These days, it's much more through wellness, where people think that they are doing the healthy thing, but that becomes extreme. So something called orthorexia, which isn't officially in the kind of diagnostic criteria of eating disorders, but it is still sort of recognized. But it's when people eat extremely clean to an extreme where it causes them so much anxiety and they become really rigid and they can't eat out and it causes, you know, it takes over their life basically. And in the pursuit of wellness and health, they've actually become really unwell. They've often become malnourished, lost a lot of weight, and have obsessive routines.
So in its simplest form, this is someone who, you know, said, right, I'm going to eat healthy. Like, so if I decide I'm going to have a healthy week or something, but then someone brings in a fabulous pudding and I think, oh, never mind, I'll just have that pudding today and it's fine. Actually, it doesn't make any difference. But if that kind of pushes you over the edge into a bit of a tiz of, I can't possibly eat that, you know, it's just not healthy, is it? I mean, that's not regular behavior.
Yeah, I mean, it's not healthy. People can become extremely anxious about food, you know, thinking about food, preoccupied with food all the time. And also many people, I work with a lot of people who are in the wellness space who have also developed binge eating because they've tried to be almost too strict. It's not sustainable. And then behind closed doors, they're binge eating and really, really struggling. And that's really hard to talk about, maybe when your public presence is very much about wellness.
I think there are sort of some famous people that say what they eat on social media and all the rest of it. I wonder if they realize just how many people might sort of take their advice to the, you know, absolute letter and follow it. So, you know, they could be causing real harm in some cases.
Yeah, and it's really, really unhelpful. And I think what's difficult is I think people often don't realize that their relationship with food has become disordered. You know, I think often people start off on that I'm being healthy road and it kind of creeps more and more into the disordered eating place. But people often haven't kind of realized that's what's happened. So they're kind of putting out this good information and it aligns with everything, you know, the government talks about and healthy eating. And, you know, if we see someone exercising a lot and eating green food all the time, you tend to get praised and validated and on a pedestal of health. But actually, someone might actually really be struggling. So, yeah, it can be quite dangerous.
And sort of in recent history, have you seen this sort of behaviour more and more? It sounds like you may have done.
Yeah, I mean, I think more and more of my clients pursue health, wellness, watch all these what I eat in a day videos. It's very sort of normalised, isn't it, as part of our culture. So, yeah, it can be quite problematic.
Goodness me. All right. Well, we've spoken a fair amount of the problem and what, in some simple terms, what causes it. If you feel that you might be slipping into this world, what can you do? Actually, or is it normally, do people realise themselves, or is it very often left to a family member or a friend to say, look, come on, you need to do something about this?
Yeah, well, it can be a mixed bag, really. I mean, I think eating disorders are what we call egosyntonic, which means that someone gets a lot from the eating disorder. So in the same way, I guess, where someone's using alcohol or drugs or something, you're kind of gaining something from it in the same way that you're losing a lot as well. So there's a lot of ambivalence, people being in two minds about change. So this is the problem because it takes a long time to diagnose people often because they don't realise there's a problem. And when people around them start to express concern, it's very common that someone might genuinely say, look, I'm just being healthy. You know, they don't see it's a problem. And then when it does creep into that more difficult place as well, I guess there's a lot of shame, because if they feel like, oh my goodness, you know, I'm this kind of healthy person with this identity of, you know, doing all these wonderfully healthy things, but they're really binge eating, over exercising, etc. It is quite hard to talk about that, I guess, and bring it out into the light. But I think the first place to go to, if you are struggling, is to go and look at the BEAT website. That's BEAT, and that's the National Association for Eating Disorders. So if you are listening and you think you may be struggling, that's a great place to go just to read a bit more about the different eating disorders and to see if you relate to anything. And sometimes it's just telling someone close to you and actually saying it out loud, because I think acknowledging there's a problem, like with anything, is often the first step towards change.
Okay. All right. What about if it's the other way around? If you notice, you know, a family member or a friend or a work colleague, you think, their behavior seems a little bit different. I'm a bit worried. Perhaps they've got some kind of eating disorder. What should you do? How should you approach the subject? Or, you know, it's kind of a difficult one. What's advice for those sort of people?
Yeah, like, I guess it's trying to be sort of quietly and gently supportive without being too over controlling or, you know, scaring the person off. I mean, there's a helpful model called the Maudsley Animal Model, which is produced for carers to help them understand how to support someone. And it's a great model. In very simple terms, it says, don't be the rhino. So the rhino steps in and says, oh my goodness, you know, you're not eating. This is what you need to do. You know, the rhino is very direct. And I guess someone will really push back against the rhino. It says, don't be the ostrich, ignoring the problem, just pretending it's not there. That's not helpful either. Don't be the jellyfish, where you become more emotional than the person struggling, you know, because you're so worried. So they won't want to talk to you. So it says, be the dolphin and the St. Bernard dog. So the dolphin listens alongside, you know, might express, you know, I've noticed perhaps you're struggling a bit with food. Do you want to talk about it? Stays very calm, very supportive. So kind of is there when the person is ready to take that step. But it's important not to force it, because in a way it can drive someone to be more secretive and to deny the problem more if you push.
Goodness me. All right. And is there help available on the NHS?
Yes, so there is. It's a bit of a postcode lottery in terms of what help will be available in your area. But most NHS services nowadays, you know, will have a proper eating disorder service, inpatient and outpatient, predominantly outpatient. Most people will be treated with sort of therapy, dietetics, etc. So it depends a bit on your area. But right. If you go to your doctor, you should be able to be referred to the NHS and to have an assessment for an eating disorder.
Yeah. So to access that, you need to go and see your GP, I'm assuming. Yeah.
Yeah, I think some services now you may be able to self-refer, but definitely historically it's more been through the GP route.
Okay. And in your work, do you find, if you know, if people do have an eating disorder, I can imagine it being taking quite a long time to fix, because these things can take a long time to happen. You're nodding your head. I mean, how long is a piece of string, I suppose, but is there an average to how long it can take to help someone, and how do you help them?
So, I mean, it's mainly a sort of psychological approach. Initially, it would be a lot of helping someone understand why they're using the eating disorder as a coping strategy, looking a bit at their history and working a lot around motivation for change. You know, you wouldn't be on day one thinking about, OK, let's put some active strategies in place. So a lot of it's kind of that pre-work, really helping someone as well understand, OK, I'm using this to cope. Actually, do I want to be using this as a coping strategy for the next 5, 10? You know, so you're helping someone start to think about different options. And I guess eating disorder treatment can be anything from 6 months up to several years. I think particularly with anorexia nervosa, that is often a longer term treatment. But people can often get to a place where they're much more head above water, and then they're functioning a lot better. And then there may be, you know, ongoing progress to get to the place they really want to get to.
Okay. I think the thing that I'm discovering from this chat is that it's not simple at all. And I'm just thinking how lucky I am that I don't suffer and no one in my family suffers, because it's, you know, it can be quite a problem for sufferers. But having said that, it's an issue that can be addressed. And maybe a good way to finish is would give this organisation BEAT, just give their name and web address again, and give yours as well, because you help people in this situation, don't you?
Yeah, so the BEAT website, I don't know offhand actually, but it's BEAT, it's the National Association for Eating Disorders. So if you put BEAT, National Association for Eating Disorders, into Google, you will get the link there. Okay. So my website is theeatingdisordertherapist.co.uk, and I've also got a podcast, The Eating Disorder Therapist. So if maybe you're new to eating disorders, you're worried about someone, you want to dip your toe a bit in the water, that can be a good place to start as well, to listen to some of those episodes.
Okay, and that's easy to find. We just tap in Harriet Fruit podcast and it'll pop up.
Yes.
Excellent. All right. Look, Harriet, thank you very much indeed for chatting. I think this is an important topic and potentially can help a lot of people. So many thanks.
Okay, thank you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimising your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
My guests for the next section, which is on diets and fad diets, are Professor James Stubbs. He is an appetite and energy balance expert from the University of Leeds, and also Sophie Higginbottom. She is a slimming success. She has lost a lot of weight and been able to keep it off. So the topic is diets and fad diets. And I started off by saying that my thought is that generally, if you lose weight quickly as part of a crash diet or a fad diet, you're pretty much almost doomed to failure. And I asked if that was in fact correct.
Scientifically, the more rapidly you lose weight, the more rapidly you're likely to rebound. But that's not quite the issue here, because that's about how quickly you lose weight. This is about whether you lose weight at all. And it seems that nearly 42% of the adult population are trying to lose weight a year, and most of them are unsuccessful. We need to understand better why people are not successful. A big survey we did across Europe a few years ago in 2000 people showed that 66% of people trying to lose weight did not use any evidence-based approaches at all.
Are we talking in the UK or Europe, the developed world?
UK, Portugal, Denmark.
Okay.
And what we found is that the people who use more evidence-based approaches lose more weight, and the people who use the least evidence-based approaches lose the least weight. And to me, a fad diet is something that's not supported by evidence, or the basis of the evidence looks implausible. It looks too good to be true.
So my initial thought, I'll just explain it, and then you can explain why it's wrong or what have you. That if you do one of these fad diets, so you eat very little, you lose a lot of weight, you're kind of fighting against almost thousands of years of evolution, because the body is designed, if it goes without, to try and get some storage down in case that happens again.
Well, some fad diets are just not effective. Things like green coffee, green tea, vitamin water. Some fad diets, actually, like the cabbage diet or juicing diet, are basically persuading you to eat a very, very limited range of pretty much raw foods and to exclude 90%+ of the foods available. And so they might produce a little bit of weight loss, but can you sustain that?
Sure. I mean, and there are some crazy ones out there. So, Sophie, what's the craziest one you've come across?
I did one that said I would lose, I think it was either half a stone or a stone in 5 days. I tried it. It involved me eating a dry, crisp bread and tuna with nothing on it for lunch. And I think I was allowed a black coffee as well. But it was completely restrictive, and I think I lasted about 3 days and then probably reverted back to eating either, you know, what I ate before or more.
So I mean, it's funny. I guess the other thing to think about is what drives us to do these things, because in their heart of hearts, most people really know or have a good idea of what a healthy diet is. So, are you disagreeing with me? I think, am I right there? Most people really know what's good to eat.
Most people have a fair idea of what's nutritious to eat, but most people really want the promise of a solution that's almost too good to be true. The Federal Trade Commission in the US have they've actually started suing some of these organizations that make the kind of claims that we just heard, that lose a stone in a week, is that physiologically possible? No, it's not. I could do the calculations, I could show you that isn't possible to achieve for most people. And so the Federal Trade Commission in the US have basically said, look, any promise of miraculous weight loss is untrue. There is no magic way to lose weight without a sensible diet and exercise. No single product, crisp bread, tuna, vitamin water, or anything else will let you eat all the food you want and still lose weight. Permanent weight loss requires permanent lifestyle changes. And things that promise lightning fast weight loss sound too good to be true simply because they are too good to be true.
The only real thing to do is to eat properly and healthily and do a bit of exercise. That's it. End of story.
No, that's not the end of the story, because that's the principle, but the practice is actually really quite difficult. Losing weight is not easy. It's a long haul. And using the ways to steer yourself to a healthy, nutritious diet, using the ways to increase your physical activity, and using techniques to change your behavior, all that are evidence-based, are going to make it less of a mystery, more effective, and more likely that you will sustain that pathway to lasting weight loss. This is a bit of a long haul. We're not in this for a week.
And it's a case of changing how your mind works as opposed to how your guts work. Is that
It's essentially both. So we know that core features of evidence-based weight management programs include dietary approaches that steer people to less energy-rich, more nutrient-rich foods. We know that gradually helping people move from being sedentary to less sedentary, to moderately active, to regularly active, is a pathway that we want to get people on. And we know that we need to get people involved in evidence-based behavior change approaches, which involve setting goals, planning, relapse prevention. And we also know that we need to wrap around that strategies of social and emotional support, because as humans, we're highly social animals, and we need that kind of support to get us through the times when things don't go so well. You're not going to find that in a vitamin water.
No. So let's bring in Sophie at this point, because you know you've actually walked the walk, you've done it. What sort of support did you find the most useful or the most necessary?
I think for me with Slimming World, because you, I mean, you can attend a group, although you can do Slimming World online. I did it in person. I think going to group and making friends, having the support of a consultant. So actually, when things do go wrong, which they do, you know, in everyday life, and that happens to everyone, you can get, you know, they can signpost you to support, or you can just get that in the group itself with people that are like-minded. You know, they've got, they also love food just as much as you do. So you've got, you know, things in common. That was really important for me.
Okay. And how, well, tell us a bit about your experience. How much weight have you lost and over what time period?
So I lost just under 9 stone, and it took me just under 2 years. So I think it's 21 months, which whilst, you know, it might sound like a long time, it didn't really feel like a long time. I think because with Slimming World, I wasn't restricted. So it was a lifestyle change. I only made kind of simple swaps in my diet. I enjoyed food whilst doing it. You know, I was excited about each meal. So actually, yeah, it didn't feel very long at all. So 2 years and 9 stone, it's great.
Okay. And then after having kind of achieved this, you know, 9 stone loss in just under 2 years, which, you know, which is pretty extraordinary. What about your life now? Because you've got to keep that going, haven't you? You can't revert to your old ways. So are you now confident that you know no weight's going to go back on?
Yeah, I've even since losing the weight, I had a baby. I still went to Slimming World. You can still follow the plan whilst pregnant, although, you know, you can have some extra things with that. I did, you know, I gained a little bit of weight during pregnancy, but then managed to get that straight back off because of the support that I had from group and with Slimming World. And I think, yeah, it's just, as I said, it's a lifestyle change. So I just changed some things in my life and their habits that I've continued. And so I don't ever feel like I need to, you know, get back on a diet, because it wasn't a diet to start off with.
Okay, no, good point. What one thing that I'm very keen to explore, and both of you may well have some input into this, is that a lot of people follow social media, people that have massive social media followings, and they'll say, oh, I did this and I lost so much weight and all that, again, based on nothing. But it has a tremendous influence on people. Have you noticed this kind of issue being more of a problem in the last 10, 20 years?
I think in all walks of life, it's a problem. And I'm not an expert in this area, but I do know that one of the key problems is social media algorithms feed you information based on what you're interested in. So there is no reference to evidence. There's no way of evaluating the quality of what you're receiving. It's an enhanced clickbait kind of ecosystem in which it works. But the problem potentially is if you're looking for objective information through social media, you might go off on a crazy tangent. Mm-hmm. Because anybody can contribute to social media. Anybody can be an expert. And that takes us away from the evidence. Like all of public health and medical practice is based on evidence. So if you've got high blood pressure, they'll give you drugs that will, or diabetes, they will give you drugs. Not, they won't just try any old drugs. They'll give you drugs based on evidence because they know it works. It's exactly the same in relation to weight and weight loss. And Sophie made a really interesting point, which really was about what happens after you've lost weight. You cannot just lose weight and walk away from it and think, I'm done with this. You have to develop new habits through behavior change, which take time, and there will be setbacks. And by using evidence-based approaches, you can turn older habits into new habits which become sustainable. And that requires the use of evidence-based approaches to be most successful.
Sure. One thing which I'm keen to ask about, and again, actually, this is probably something I've seen on social media, but I have read the old article and actually one book on it as well. And that's UPF, ultra-processed food. Now, this is getting more and more common in our diet, and there's some very scary statistics. And we all eat ultra-processed food, or, well, pretty much all of us. Even we might try not to, but we end up eating it one way or another. And this has been the case for, you know, the last few decades. And it's the last few decades that more and more people have been getting fatter and fatter. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the two are connected, but is there a chance that actually it's like one big experiment? And I'm not saying this is a big conspiracy theory, but our diets are changing and we're getting fatter. It's
really interesting question. The if you like, the scientific dogma on this at the moment is that the ready availability of calorie dense, highly processed, highly palatable, durable, in other words, things that can stay on shelves in supermarkets for long periods of time, cheap foods makes us overeat. And in a conversation like this, yes, you could say generically that's true. As a scientist, we need to unpick what those mechanisms are. Is it the composition? Is it the sensory properties of the foods? How does what's in the food interact with the sensory properties of the foods? How does it relate to how those foods are made, which is the processing thing? And it will be, in truth, a little bit more complex, because it will be a bit of each of those. And those are actually the models we're working to unpick at the University of Leeds in what's a project called the SatMap or Satiety Map project. But that's a bit outside of the theme of today's talk.
I'm getting the feeling that might be a whole series at some time in the future.
Yeah.
Well, James, maybe I'll need to invite you back for that series. But certainly, for just for now, if people are struggling with, you know, trying loads of different diets, having no success, a good, sensible way forward and a good source of information to help them in the initial stages, can you both sort of suggest somewhere where people can look for some sensible, simple information?
Sure. If you want to review diet and weight loss approaches, go to NHS Better Health. It's got all the evidence-based approaches are kind of mentioned there. To understand about Slimming World, go to slimmingworld.co.uk. And the key message, I think, is do take a little bit of time to work out where there is evidence behind the approach that you are considering taking.
Because excellent. No, that sounds like good, very good advice. And Sophie, on the website, is your story there?
Yes, it is. And also, I know you said about the negative kind of impact of social media, but actually there's a really large Slimming World kind of social media community. Slimming World themselves, you know, post things up there, and I find that really helpful. On their social media and the website as well.
Yeah, good. All right. Well, look, thank you very much to both of you for chatting, because this is an important issue. It affects a lot of people. So hopefully this will be helpful to many of them. So many thanks.
Thank you. Nice to chat.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were Harriet Frew talking about eating disorders, and then Professor James Stubbs and Sophie Higginbottom talking about diets and fad diets. And of course, a major thanks to you for listening, and please have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.